You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and on the line with us is America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, host of Ring of Fire Radio, Ring of Fire TV, and Free Speech TV. You can find it, and an attorney. You can find it all over at, and an author. You can find it all over at ringoffireradio.com. Hey, Pap, how you doing today?
Tom, how are you?
Well. So Mitch McConnell shows up in a room full of billionaires, and hilarity ensues. Is that the storyline? Am I getting that right?
That's it. His first line is, gee, I'm not going to do any of those gosh darn things they want me to on liberal things like safety nets and health care. Just went on and on. I thought what was interesting about it, though, is, you know, we don't need this audio testimony, this audio show that was put on by these really bottom feeder politicians. We don't really even need that to understand how much harm the Kochs have visited on America. We already have this spectacular trail of really disasters. I mean, pillage all along the way firsthand. They're already winning. All we have to do is look in Wisconsin. If you remember, they had their well-trained servant, Scott Walker, obliterate labor unions, work to restrict voting only to affluent white voters. He pushed to privatize charter schools that are now, by the way, being raided by the FBI for corruption all over the United States. In Florida, the Koch brothers' bagman, this is another Koch brother connection, Rick Scott followed all orders to the T. He granted offshore drilling access, almost unlimited in some situations. He shut down environmental enforcement actions of every kind. He killed the high-speed rail, Tom, that was going to create 10,000 permanent jobs in America. He purged the voting rolls. So the point is, yes, this meeting took place, and we heard these bottom feeders like Joni Ernst get up and literally say, we'll do, this Republican from New Mexico, we will do, Koch brothers, whatever you ask us to do. And, or how about the stop? How about the statement that came from Tom Cotton, this wanker from Arkansas? Cotton gets up and says, our role basically is just to stop Obama on everything he wants to accomplish. But the thing is, they didn't know they were being recorded, obviously. But when you drill down to what they were saying, we already know that. We already know that they're appreciative to the, just beholding to the Koch brothers, because they know the Koch brothers are bankrolling them. I mean, these retreats were the Kochs, where they bring in cheap character politicians. They can be purchased for campaign money. And this has been going on for years. The results have been staggering. They've purchased governors, Walker, Scott, Kasich, Christie, McDonnell, and about a half dozen more Republican governors. On the national scale, they've almost made a wholesale purchase of corporate-owned judges from the trial level all the way to the Supreme Court. So although this is interesting to look at and to read, we already know it's happening. And as a matter of fact, oddly enough, if you go back years ago when Hillary Clinton said there is a right-wing plan, basically, she called it a right-wing conspiracy of sorts. I wish she hadn't used that word. It's a business plan. It's less than it is a conspiracy. But the business plan is to completely take over the major institutions in this country. And so these politicians showed up at the Koch brothers' special party that they have every year, and they made their oath of blood to these awful characters, the Koch brothers.
You know, the Declaration of Independence, most people have memorized the first half of a sentence. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, etc., life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But the second half of that sentence, most people don't have memorized. And it continues after a dash. It says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, and that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such a form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Are we beyond the point where we can fix this with something like McCain-Feingold? Mitch McConnell said in that meeting that the worst day of his life was when McCain-Feingold was passed. The Supreme Court has blown it up. Are we a full-on oligarchy now, Pap?
There's no question. That was the last part, you see. When you control the last part and the money moves in to where they can actually buy every major institution, whether it's the Senate, whether it's the House of Representatives, whether it's the Supreme Court, whether it's media, whether it's the courts from the trial level up, whether it's local legislature, they needed that money to do it. And what people don't understand about Citizens United is Karl Rove and his gang started working on this years and years ago, all the way back to the time, that was 1992, the big Republican regime comes in all over the country and sweep this House, sweep the Senate, sweep the courts. I remember I was trying a case out in Houston, Texas, when that happened. And I remember the judge saying to me that this is something that may be irreversible. Very wise judge that was out there. And what she was saying basically is it's got so much steam behind it, you can't really change it from the inside out. Now, there are some hopeful things here. Bernie Sanders now is looking more like he is serious about running for president. He's wisely traveling throughout the country, making stops primarily in the South, which is interesting. South Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, places that seem like they're completely contrary to everything that Bernie Sanders stands for. But what's important about Bernie Sanders is to raise the conversation, Tom, to be out there talking about these issues. We're living in a time where a guy like Rick Scott in Florida might be reelected. Our Scott Walker up in Wisconsin might be reelected, even though we know there are criminal thugs. We know how bad they are. It's almost as if part of the public is in a suspension of disbelief right now. And so maybe it takes a Bernie Sanders to shake up that suspension of disbelief and say, no, this is real. You don't have to pinch yourself. You're not dreaming. This is really happening to America right now. But I guess the thing that's most frustrating to me is I understand that people still don't get it. And all you have to do is look at the numbers in some of these races where these absolute horrible characters, not just because of gerrymandering, by the way. I'm talking about governor races. I'm talking about Senate races where the public still doesn't understand what's happening to them. That's very disheartening to me. And I'm hoping a guy like Bernie Sanders can shake them up a little bit and say, no, here's what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. It's I think we live at a very, very pivotal time. And well, we'll see where this goes. But go ahead.
What is your thought about Bernie Sanders running as an independent or a Democrat? I'm interested to know.
I think he's pretty much said on this program that if he runs, it'll be in the Democratic primary, and his goal will be to push the Democrats, you know, to the left.
Does that work in your mind? Does the public pay enough attention to the words that are being spoken about how bad things really are?
Yeah, I think it can have some substantial effect. Bernie is turning out to be having a lot broader base than I think the party graybeards believed, and they're starting to take him seriously. Elizabeth Warren is the other wild card. She's clearly not running for president right now because when she does gigs, she doesn't collect email addresses, which is like the first, warning flag. But I think there's a possibility she's running for vice president. And that provides some interesting ideas. Who knows?
You raise the issue that sometimes you have to start again, and it's going to take something. It's going to take the kind of discussion that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren can have with this country to even have them thinking about starting again.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. And interestingly, on the right, Rand Paul is raising some interesting issues. The problem is he's got so much toxic baggage with him for everything else. Mike Papantonio, host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com, the website, America's Attorney. Thanks, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always great talking. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Be sure to check out Pap's website, ringoffireradio.com. And welcome back. And just Pap, you're still with us?
Yes, I am.
Great. Uh-huh. Just a quick note for all our viewers on Free Speech TV. Yesterday you saw a Best Of show. Because even though we were live on the air, because our machine that produces television, it's called a TriCaster, croaked. Just as we were going on the air, the hard drive apparently totally failed. It's being shipped off to be repaired. That's the bad news. The good news is we have an older one, which is our backup, which we're using right now. So for the next couple of weeks, things are going to look a little different on the screen, but everything else should be just fine. So, and we are back on live. Today is Thursday. So, and Mike Papantonio is with us, the host of Ring of Fire Radio, and right here on Free Speech TV, Ring of Fire TV. And so, Pap, what's coming up on the show this weekend?
Well, I saw you interview Thomas Frank a few weeks ago, so I put him on where he's going to be on our show. He's going to talk about how Obama has allowed the Republicans to shape Obama's legacy. I think it's an interesting conversation. David Tissell is going to talk about how some of Obama's top former advisors that used to be so pro-union are now going to work to destroy labor in this country. Incredible story. Ruth Conniff of Progressive Magazine is going to tell us why the FBI is investigating charter schools all over the country, busting in, taking their records, taking their computers, and indicting and putting people in prison. Howard Nations is going to explain how local police have gotten their hands on so many ugly little implements of harm that they're using against our populace right now. So we've got a pretty diverse kind of topic. I think one of the topics that needs more discussion, and I know you talk about it, I talk about it all the time, is something is different now in America about the way that police do their job. Yeah. And it's not just our imagination. The empirical data is there. The audios are there. The videos are there, story after story, every single week, where somebody's tased to death, somebody's shot that's completely innocent, completely unarmed. These stories, I don't remember these stories ever, one right after another, like we're seeing now. So there's a fundamental problem with law enforcement in this country, and it's systemic. I don't think it's localized. I think it's systemic.
One of the things I find fascinating, and I'm not sure which is the chicken and which is the egg here, a year and a half, 2 years ago when I had that surgery and I was out for a couple of weeks and Louise had her surgery at the same time. And so we just laid in bed and watched Netflix. And I watched a year and a half, 2 years worth of CSI Miami's and a whole bunch of, and we went back and watched the old cop shows from when we were young. We watched all the old Columbos and McMillan and Wife and all these. And back in the 70s and 80s, the cop shows, they'd knock on the door and the guy would say, "Do you have a warrant?" And the cops would say no. And he'd say, "Go away." And they'd go walk off muttering. Flash forward to today, and you look at the cop shows, and literally on CSI Miami, Lieutenant, what's his name, the good guy, he's torturing people illegally. Torturing people. They're doing police brutality, and they're doing it with a wink and a nod to each other, to these, clearly bad guys. But I wonder to what extent the police forces of America are being trained by cop shows. And that we should be having a serious conversation with Hollywood about the way that they portray police.
Well, I think it's an awful... Well, you're right, but I think it's an awful statement when you say that police are so impressionable, these characters that we hire are so impressionable, that they see something on TV and they try to emulate. But the truth is, Marcus Aurelius said, "We become what we think about," in so many words. And that is true. These guys think about being, Bruce Willis, and that's what they try to emulate.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, it's just something I've been scratching my head about for about a year. Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com and Ring of Fire TV on Sunday at noon right here on Free Speech TV. Thanks, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, there's a lot in the news today. Georgia man is dead after police used their tasers multiple times. Mr. Scorpio posting this over at DU. It's actually a link out of addictinginfo.info. The police used their tasers like a cattle prod to get this guy to walk, and he died from it. They tased him 13 times. One cop did 10 of them. Police officer by the name of Marcus Eberhard. And was the guy talking back? Was he yelling at him? No, he was saying, "I'm tired." They had chased him for a ways, and when he could no longer walk, they used the tasers to move him. He wasn't cursing, he wasn't abusive, he was saying, "I'm tired." The autopsy has ruled that the death was a homicide caused by taser shocks and the physical weakness Towns incurred by running. Gregory Towns was the name of the black guy that got tased to death by the Georgia police. It's incredible. Just 7 children a day die in the United States from gunshots. Vast majority of them accidental. Tom Corbett is the governor of Pennsylvania, is he not? He's running for re-election. And his campaign has released some interesting information. He is trailing by 72 points in Philadelphia, by 28 in Montgomery, by 26 in Lackawanna, in 20 in Bucks County, in North, these are county numbers, in Northampton County, by, he's trailing by 13, in Chester by 12, in Luzerne by 12. So what do they say they have to do? What does the Corbett campaign say they have to do? An internal campaign document just got leaked. This is also over Democratic Underground. J.P. Zenger posted it. The original is from politicspa.com, Pennsylvania Politics website. It says the campaign needs to focus on increasing favorability or demotivating oppositional turnout. I've been telling you about this for years. It's been a while since I've talked about it, but I think it's really worth revisiting. Demotivating oppositional turnout is campaign speak for cause people who would vote for Corbett's opponent, for the Democrat, to not bother coming to the polls. We have this belief in America. Average voters believe that when they see negative advertising, an ad that says, oh, this guy's a bum, you know, or the pseudo-negative advertising that the big super PACs and the Koch brothers and Americans for Prosperity and whatnot run, where they call it issue advertising, so they get around campaign finance laws, and they'll say, we have a terrible unemployment problem here in X County, and it's being made worse by the policies of Democrat Joe Blow. Please call Joe Blow and tell him that you don't like his policies that are destroying jobs. Right. That sort of thing. And it's a sideways attack. Or, you know, he's destroying jobs by wanting the EPA to regulate emissions from Koch brothers owned. Well, they don't say that, refineries. But what most people assume when they see negative ads like this is that the goal of the negative ad is to get people not to show up, but to show up and vote for the other guy. In other words, people watch negative ads and they assume that the goal of the negative advertiser is to get you to vote for their guy. If for no other reason than that you're voting against the guy that got the negative ad, right? Against whom the negative ad was directed. But reality, the fact of the matter is that the way negative advertising works is it suppresses voter turnout. And Republicans have known this since the Lee Atwater, Ronald Reagan days. Democrats have figured this out in the last 10, 15 years. And it's become conventional wisdom in political circles, but average people don't know this. And the negative ad doesn't even have to be real. I mean, they just make stuff up to complain about. I mean, you've got one of these races here, and there's something going on right now. But probably in several races now, you've got Republicans running negative ads against Democrats for supporting something that the Republicans supported. Or for doing something that was like some minor marginal procedural thing in the House of Representatives, they blow it all up. It doesn't even have to be. Well, you know, they're technically true, but they don't have to have the integrity of truth. It doesn't matter if you can just smear your opponent. What it does is it suppresses voter turnout, and then you throw out red meat to your base, like you put something on the ballot. You know, 10 years ago, it was you put on the ballot a constitutional amendment to end gay marriage or prohibit gay marriage in your state. Or you put on the ballot, you know, something to stop abortion. You identify slices of your base. Groups that don't like black people, groups that don't like gay people, groups that are, you know, that are misogynistic and don't like women.
whatever it may be, you identify these slices and you throw red meat out to them by putting things on the ballot or by running candidates or whatever. In other words, you figure out how to get your base out, but then you suppress the overall vote, particularly the opposition vote. You're not trying to buy votes. You're not trying to get voters to move over to your side. The Republicans are not trying to get people to move over to the Republican side. They're trying to get Democrats to throw their hands up and say, screw it, they're all bums. My guy's a bum, they must all be bums. I'm not even going to vote. That's what they're trying to do. And by the way, they are successful at it. This is how the Republicans had their, quote, sweep in 2010. And they're going to do it, and they're doing it again right this very minute. We really need publicly funded elections.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, of course, publicly funded elections means we need a new Supreme Court. We need to amend the Constitution to say, sorry, money is not speech. It's the place where people dare, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Is Hobby Lobby a person? Oh, no, 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 no. The Supreme Court has it all wrong. They do not know what they're talking about. And we've got to do something about that. By the way, Senator Sanders will be with us the third hour of our show today, one and one half hours from now. Bernie will be taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. We're going to be doing it on Thursday instead of Friday this week. So just an FYI and get your questions ready and all that kind of thing. Zeph in Fort Bragg, California. Hey, Zeph, you wanted to talk about John Boehner?
Yes, I saw him 3 years ago on Friday, the day before Memorial Day, and he gave a little speech in front of the flags with the Ryan, I think. But he said, basically, he's going to kill the beast, the middle class. And then he bragged about that the day that the RNC, the convention, was on hold because of the hurricane that was coming through Tampa.
Right.
And he was going, oh, they'll never see that because I was on late Friday on Memorial Day weekend.
I thought the beast he was talking about was government, that he was doing. He was trying to out-Reagan Reagan.
Yeah, oh, yeah. He's trying to do something. I don't know what.
But, you know, the reality that I think most Americans don't get, and it's really unfortunate because I think most Americans did get it back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s even, was that without a strong government regulating the rules of the game of capitalism, you don't have a middle class because, the normal rules of capitalism don't produce a middle class. They produce the working poor. And, a very small professional middle class, doctors and lawyers, and then, the very, very wealthy. And so, interesting. Very interesting. Zeph, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for the reminder, the little historical reminder. Anything goes summer, by the way, whatever you'd like to talk about. Don in Palmdale, California. Hey, Don, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I get the progressive populist and the let's the issue. There's an article by Bob Burnett, Getting Democrats to Vote, and he talks about the Pew Research Center political typology poll, and it gets broken down into different sections and clusters. And the bottom line is, he says, the midterm problem for Democrats is that they have to get the base out. Solid liberals are 21%, next generation left it's 11%, and faith and family left 12%.
Folks who intend to vote?
Pardon me?
These percentages are percentages of people who intend to vote? Or they're percentages of those groups as a total slice of what, the electorate or the Democratic Party?
They're the base that needs to be able to vote.
Right, but those percentages represent what?
The percentage of people who have to, are the base that need to get out and vote, who may not get out to vote.
Okay, so when you said 12%, does that mean that 12% of the base needs to get out, or that that base represents 12% of the party?
21% of solid liberals, 11% of next generation left, 12% of faith and family left, and that's a total of 44%. And the kicker is the skeptics, the hard-pressed skeptics, represent 9%. And that's what is going to have to come out to vote if we're going to.
Okay, so these are slices of the Democratic Party electorate, basically.
Yeah, and so my feeling is this: I think that we're going about this in exactly the wrong way, and the fact that you just mentioned the negative ads kind of feeds into this. We have to convince Democrats who aren't likely to vote, who vote in the who don't vote midterm but vote for the general elections. And my feeling is this: we're going about it all wrong in getting people motivated. And even though Bob Burnett says that it's the bread and butter issues that are going to be the major thing, my feeling is that people just aren't aware of what the bread and butter issues are.
Yeah.
I'm a chiropractor, and I see a lot of patients, and I sort of feel them out to find out what their political bent is and if they're willing to engage me in a political conversation. And what I found is that people are really quite ignorant. I'm talking about people who have high technology jobs that work for JPL, and they counter the global warming thing. Social Security isn't going to be there for them. It's the same thing that we hear all the time.
Right.
And so my feeling is that we have to convince these people about voting for their own best interests, and the only way that we can get to them is by as we ramp up for the elections, having them confronted. But the only way they're going to be confronted is what they see in the media. They're not going to be confronted by me, because it's really difficult for me to draw anybody out into a political conversation, because they're just not interested. So my proposal is this: we need to give them a reason why they shouldn't vote. And if you don't care about Social Security and don't care if it's going to be there in the future, don't vote. If you don't care about Medicare and you're Democrat, don't vote. If you don't care about the minimum wage, don't vote. Getting people back to work by putting them, getting the infrastructure fixed, if you don't care about that, don't vote. And you can reverse this for Republicans. If you're a Republican and you don't care about Social Security being there, vote Republican. We just reverse the whole thing.
Right.
And the second thing that I really feel ticked off about is the negative ads, and how our candidates really don't know how to respond to negative advertising. It's a simple thing. You have the candidate stand in front of the negative ad rolling behind them and just, look quizzically and say, "Do you believe this? This is not true." And then give a reason why it's not true. As the thing is playing, you save money by, you don't have to have large production credits. You let all the money be spent by the other side, and you just stand there and counter their argument. Do you want who do you want to be to choose the next Supreme Court justice? If you don't care about that, don't vote. But the idea is, save the money, stand in front of the of their negative ads, and mock it for what the piece of crap that it is.
Yeah, I don't disagree, Don. I think that it's unfortunately, when you do that shotgun approach that you're describing, most people are going to tune out. Each one of those individual slices needs to be developed as its own ad, but that point, I think, is a really, really good point, and we have to get the base out to vote. You're absolutely right. Thanks a lot for the call. David, in Anderson, South Carolina, you wanted to talk about Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, I'm hoping that just maybe his coming down here might get a lot of people out to vote and actually reach some of the people that have been disenfranchised by the Democratic Party down here. Whether they've intended to or not, I think they've managed to successfully marginalize white Southern male voters for the last couple of decades. I mean, even the Economist, the British publication, has done several articles over the years at election time of what the hell are the Democrats thinking. This is how they could get the voters, but they seem to just give it up that they're not going to win down here. And I do believe that if somebody were to get a little more plain talking and quit trying to act like a Democrat in name only, and trying to be more conservative and Republicans when they run for election down here and even on a national platform, they might get some of these guys to come out and vote.
Yeah.
Bernie doesn't take prisoners when he's in debates, so I'm hoping that he will run, because frankly, I'm not one of the people who's been holding my, been breathless for the return of Hillary.
Yeah.
Because I'm tired of the same old brand. I'm tired of the MSNBC brand of cookie cutter Democrats who, play up what they think are sexy topics for the people that are already in the, you know, what's the old expression, preaching to the,
choir.
They're preaching to their choir, outside of one or two people over there. And yesterday when I saw Ed Schultz's show and he was talking to Bernie, I was like, you know, you were talking about getting excited about politics for the first time in a while.
Yeah.
That kind of excited me. I hope that, like, nobody's business that the guy runs. I mean, I'll get out there. I'll get out there whether I can afford to or not, and I'll walk door to door.
Yeah. I'm totally with you, David. And this, you know, there was that moment back in, I think it was 2000, when, wasn't that when Howard Dean was running in the primary? And, you know, ultimately to run against George W. Bush, and you know, he got taken down basically by his own party and the news media. But they had the 50-state strategy. He was representing the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, was actively taking on the power interests within the Democratic Party. And I think that's one of the reasons, frankly, that he got taken down, that Howard Dean, you know, that they exaggerated that Mike moment, and you know, both sides went with it. Because the Democrats wanted somebody who was safer, and
I think that down here they really need to get serious about expanding it. There are racist people down here, and a lot of them are white males. But there's a lot of us who vote Democrat. I voted Democrat for years. There's a lot of Democrats down here, and bedeviling us, as so often happens, again, on MSNBC, I know they're corporate, but still, people listen to them.
Yeah.
And they buy it. They have gals who get on there and, you want to talk about bashing, they white southern male bash all the time on there, and you think that all of us are card carrying members of the Klan or something.
Yeah, which is not the case. And there's no such thing as a red state or a blue state. You know, it's all purple states. Excellent point, David. Thank you for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV in Anderson, South Carolina. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, and I got to tell you, what libertarians don't know about libertarianism, it's pretty amazing. We'll get to that as we move through the show. Welcome back. Jesse in Miami, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, Mr. Bernie, I would love to vote for him if you could have a idea to say, pick up from where the move your money movement was going and turn that into a national platform to run on.
Yeah.
But I think he would need to let the people, I know he has the courage to let the people know that the system we have now is unsustainable, and pretty much we need to go to a cooperative system, pretty much to base that system off the Federal Reserve. If the people are ready. I think Mike Papatonio is wrong. The people, they ready. They want something. It just goes to show unemployed people from around the Middle East is going to keep the Arab Spring going, thinking they trying to bring about democracy. But we know the corrupt money is turning it into some Islam extremism. But basically, they going saying we support democracy, but they're getting fooled thinking that, and it's happening in Ukraine where they think they got nationalism going, but really, basically, they're being fooled, and they really want jobs, but they're being fooled into nationalism and, you know, a war between the 99%. So, but
well, and we're seeing the same thing in the United States with Christian fundamentalism, you know.
Right, right. So it's one thing or the other that's dividing us, but the thing I think would bring us together would be if Bernie could pick up where it say, hey, I'm tired of putting my money where the people's using it against me, and say, let's move it to a public, cooperative Federal Reserve, and then basically we could start little banks with that with
Elizabeth Warren.
Ellen Brown.
Ellen Brown, yeah.
Yeah, and then, please get Mr. Wolf in there. And then that lady, he should think about running for president or something. The one in Seattle.
A
socialist.
Yeah.
I love hearing that lady. She has the courage. She says, I have the courage to go against the Israeli lobby. I don't know about Bernie or Elizabeth Warren, but we need people with courage like that now, because if we don't have that courage to deal with the opposition, we ain't going to make it. So thanks for listening, Tom.
No, I'm with you, Jesse, and I think that this is one of the biggest problems that the Democratic Party has right now, is the Democrats are afraid to be Democrats. If Democrats would collectively start standing up and speaking out like FDR did, they would stop losing elections. They would start winning elections big time. And they need to be willing to say, yes, I am in favor of income redistribution, whatever you want to call it. I don't care what kind of, you know, how you want to trash it. We need strong Social Security. We need a strong minimum wage. We need strong unions. We need a strong middle class in this country. It's essential for democracy. And you've got the entire Democratic Party, a large chunk of the Democratic Party, that's just scared to death to say these things because they, you know, they don't want to offend, you know, the big banksters and whatnot who in part support the Democratic Party and I mean, support both parties, right? These guys, many of these corporations are equal opportunity politician buyers, and which gets us back to needing to get money out of politics. Jesse, thanks for the call. I mean, there's incredible promise here, right? This is the hopeful thing, is that all the surveys show that the American public is hungry for a candidate like Bernie Sanders who just tells it like it is and is an economic populist. The bad news is that the big money interests are not. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Richard in Victorville, California, you wanted to talk about negative campaigning?
Yeah, how you doing today, Tom?
I'm very well, thank you. I hope you are, too.
You know, I'm from California, and this negative campaigning thing actually worked very well for the Republicans back in the early days of the Bush administration. They used negative campaigning against Gray Davis to get our governor recalled to get Schwarzenegger in there.
Right, right.
You know, basically they did the recall based on the premise that Gray Davis was responsible for California being in these really bad deals with the electric companies, where we were like getting raked over the coals by all the power companies out there.
Yeah, when in fact it was Ken Lay and Enron who were intentionally doing it to flip the election. And Ken Lay had been secretly meeting with Schwarzenegger. When Daryl Issa found out about that, Daryl Issa had put $1 million of his own money into that campaign to take down Gray Davis because he thought he was going to be the next governor of California. And when he found out that Schwarzenegger had been meeting with these guys, meeting with Ken Lay privately, he literally on TV, live, broke down crying.
Well, and actually a lot of the deals that Gray Davis got blamed for were actually signed by his predecessor, a Republican, Pete Wilson.
Right, right.
So, and the biggest problem we saw in California was never once did Gray Davis man up and say, hey, I didn't have anything to do with any of that.
Yeah, no, he tried to be above it. He thought he could be, he thought that people were smart enough to know that a lot of the attack ads were lies. And he tried to be a gentleman and conduct himself, you know, well. And, you know, and I'm sorry, politics is, you know, what did Harry Truman say? If you want a friend in D.C., get a dog. I mean, politics is not a gentleman's sport. Politics increasingly is a blood sport.
And the Republicans understand that, and they they play well.
Oh, yeah. And they play for keeps. Richard, thank you for the call. Andy in Wilmington, Delaware. Hey, Andy, you wanted to talk about the American standard of living?
Yes, a great pleasure to talk to you. I learn something every time I listen to the show.
Thank you.
I want to talk about the American paycheck and the American standard of living. I think if you took a film crew to every country, Juarez, Malaysia, Juarez, Mexico, Malaysia, I mean, all these places, and take photographs, take film of the conditions that workers are living in, and what is being called free trip, really make the connection that this is what we're expected to compete with. That's what they consider free trade, is a competition with folks. I know for a fact down in Juarez, Mexico, you work in one of those big, like for Samsung or Motorola or any of those companies down there, you make about $70 a week.
Yeah.
And the kids don't have free education, don't have public education past the age of 14. And so they're all joining drug cartels. They got nothing to do because both parents are out there working. It's a horrible situation that we're being expected, and this is promoted by Republicans and maybe a few Democrats, but by Republicans, that's what free trade is, and you put free in front of it, it's all of a sudden it's good.
In fact, Andy, I would take it a step beyond that. I think your suggestion is brilliant. You know, show basically the sweatshops of the third world that the places to which our jobs have been exported. But then the second step, that's an indictment of free trade. But the second step is, this is what libertarians like Rand Paul and libertarian-leaning Republicans want to turn America into. You know, I mean, Rand Paul is essentially on record wanting to roll back to go back to the Lochner Court. To say no more child labor laws. That's a illegal interference in commerce between people. No more minimum wage laws. No more workplace safety laws. No more Social Security. No more Medicare. No more workman's comp. No more, you know, no more unemployment benefits. This is what these guys, you know, which means that, if, you know, eventually the United States starts to look like Malaysia. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, what I wanted to say was about the paycheck. If you look at a $20 an hour paycheck, which is just okay, what that buys you is maybe not having police or military checkpoints where you have to pay somebody off to go any further. That's the conditions. Corrupt, there's garbage in the streets, corrupt military, corrupt law enforcement.
Right.
And that's what you get for that $60 a week or you know, $5 a day or whatever the fee is.
No, you're not far from that. You're absolutely right, Andy, and that's the direction that we're going in. We need to point out both of those things. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to SiriusXM. Robert in Boston. Hey,
hi,
Robert.
Yes. I think James Carbo was right. It's the economy, stupid. And unfortunately, Democrats have not really done too well in that regard. We seem to have been divided as a party into three sections, the middle, the cultural left, and the corporate right. And the middle is getting squeezed. When you consider the damage that Bill Clinton, the standard bearer of the party, did to the economy in terms of deindustrializing the country, I mean, you look at the Ferguson. All the jobs were gone. The good-paying jobs were gone. And look at this country. I mean, we talk about American exceptionalism, okay? We are exceptional. Here we are spending billions of dollars to arm the police, militarize the police in towns and cities all over the country, and yet we're shutting off water in Detroit.
Yeah.
That's truly exceptional. I don't think this is...
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Blaming Bill Clinton for this, though, is hyper-oversimplistic. This is something Republicans have been pounding on since the Nixon administration. Reagan took us a large step in this direction with most favored nation status and these bilateral trade agreements. Clinton, yes, got us into GATT and the WTO, but he did it with the help of Newt Gingrich. I mean, the Republicans were just gung-ho for this. So this was a bipartisan mistake. What the Democrats need to do is say, you know, we were wrong, and stop promoting SHAFTA, you know, this new TPP that Barack Obama's promoting, and start repudiating all of these things. Because the one guy in that race in 1992 who was right, it wasn't Clinton, it wasn't Bush, it was Ross Perot. Robert, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And on the line with us is Peter Hanlon, Director of Water and Energy, the Water and Energy Program over at Grace Communications Foundation. GraceLinks.org is the website. Peter, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Tell me about this report that you guys published over at EcoWatch. Consumer Reports finds eating tuna too risky for pregnant women.
Sure. Well, this is actually a paper that we did based on Consumer Reports, did a study recently, and just give you a little background on what's going on. Back in June this year, the Food and Drug Administration released some new draft dietary guidelines, which encourage pregnant women to eat fish, providing not just a maximum amount they should eat each week, but also a minimum, which is a new thing for them. And the reason they did this is because the research showed that pregnant women just were not eating enough fish for the nutritional value. And so they recommended that women who are or might become pregnant, as well as young children, not to eat four particular fish species that are known to be high in mercury. And mercury is a problem because that's a neurotoxin. So particularly shark, tilefish, swordfish, king mackerel. And that's great. But one thing that was left off is tuna on that list, which it can be high in mercury at times and is actually the second most popular seafood in America. So it's just a lot of people eating a lot of tuna. So what happened is Consumer Reports looked into this draft guidelines and looked at the benefits and risks. And, you know, Consumer Reports, obviously, they're a great trusted source, great at risk assessment like this. They don't accept ads. And what they found is that the FDA's recommendations just don't quite match their data. So there's a great example of this where the FDA is saying that women should eat up to 6 ounces of albacore tuna per week. Yet, for example, a 125-pound woman would exceed the safe limit determined by EPA by only eating 4 ounces. Or a 48-pound child could surpass the same limit with just a third of a can in a week.
And that's assuming that the safe limit is actually safe. I mean, you know.
Yes. Yeah. And there is, you know, it goes back. It's still an issue to be studied. And, you know, what makes it worse, too, is sometimes the amount of mercury that's found in a can of tuna can vary really wildly from can to can. So, right. You know, the FDA's own data shows that there can be, I think there was 20% of cans tested since 2005 contain almost double the average level of what is listed.
Now, these are all large ocean fish that you're talking about. So it's the top of the food chain syndrome that presumably this is mercury coming out of coal-fired power plants.
Well, yeah, that's it. That's what makes it such a fascinating story. It's really, you know, the energy choices we're making are impacting food choices that we have to make here. So, you know, like you said, you have mercury coming out of power plants and other industrial uses, settling into the ocean. As they go down the water column, they're converted by bacteria into methylmercury, which is the really highly toxic version of mercury. And that just works its way up the food chain, and, you know, we're at the top of that. And so all that mercury is built up from, you know, smallest phytoplankton up to, let's say you had swordfish or shark or something, it'd be extremely high. And so you have to monitor how much of that fish you're eating based on the mercury levels.
Right. Has there, if I could just change the topic very slightly for a moment,
sure.
One of the big concerns because of Fukushima is that hundreds of millions of picocuries of radioactive elements, or of curies, actually, millions of curies, of radioactive cesium have been released out of Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean. This is an element. I lived in Germany the year that Chernobyl melted down, and this was a major freakout there because this stuff got in the food chain, too. Cesium, the body thinks that cesium is potassium. It thinks that strontium is calcium. There's this syndrome called Chernobyl heart. People around Chernobyl were, because the heart
absorbs so much potassium because it's constantly beating. It's a substantial muscle. That it was that the radioactive cesium was burning holes in the hearts. Is anybody looking at these ocean fish, particularly Pacific Ocean fish, that literally go from one side of the Pacific to the other in the course of their lifetimes, for cesium, or has all the attention been focused on mercury?
As far as cesium, I don't know enough about the research that's been done, but I think mercury definitely has been studied, in particular because just the explosion of coal-fired plants in China.
Right.
And we're starting to see, you know, increased levels in certain areas of the Pacific.
Concern. The original mercury freakout back in the 80s, 90s, as I recall, was all the mercury that was found in the rivers and lakes in the United States, in the continental United States. Don't eat fish that you catch. Is that still the case?
Well, it's really as the mercury works its way. There are definitely freshwater fish that are high in mercury. There's some trout, for example, that are high in mercury. If you catch them in the wild, example. So, the mercury levels thankfully in the U.S. are starting to go down as some regulations are starting to kick in.
Yeah.
But it's still a concern for freshwater as well.
Now, salmon are large predatory fish,
they are
carnivorous fish, and so you would assume that salmon would have high levels of mercury also. Is that different for farmed salmon? Because so many people say, oh, I don't want farmed salmon. I want line-caught salmon, which would be wild salmon. Isn't wild salmon far more likely to have mercury than farmed salmon? Because the farmed salmon, they feed it these pellets of whatever it is.
Right. It's actually really interesting. Wild salmon is actually extremely low in mercury and high in omega-3s and, you know, various other nutritional elements. And that's the thing about the story and, you know, sort of about the fish and mercury story is that it's not necessarily don't eat fish. It's really about just trying to avoid mercury. And
right.
Salmon's a perfect example of really low in mercury, extremely...
How does salmon avoid mercury if they're wild salmon, if they're eating other fish and those fish are eating fish who ate the phytoplankton?
Right.
Or the algae.
Things like, say, tuna, but also, you know, swordfish and everything, they're eating, like, the larger fish on the upper trophic scale, essentially, and salmon tend to eat more vegetable matter. So
salmon are omnivores rather than carnivores.
They are, yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting. I guess that makes sense because the pellets that they're feeding them, I saw the composition once of them, and they have, like, corn in them and things. I'm like, wait a minute, you're feeding this stuff?
Yeah, exactly. And it, really the way to go, honestly, is a well-managed, sustainable salmon fishery, and that goes with any fishery, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, the wild salmon it's not just, you know, for the health. There's also a whole other aspect of it's great for a lot of our fishing communities that are out there. They're really struggling to make ends meet, and there are a lot of fishermen out there that are doing the right thing, that are fishing sustainably, and that really need to capture that market. And this is another example of, you know, you eat fish that are low in mercury, you know, at the right time. You know, occasionally you can have that tuna if you're a healthy adult, but you're helping out local fisheries and you're being healthy as well.
Right. And with that tuna, do you really want that mercury? I understand mercury is like 30 or 40 times more of a neurotoxin than lead. This is potent stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Peter Hanlon, director of communications or director of the Water and Energy Program with Grace Communications Foundation. Gracelinks.org is the website. Peter, thanks for dropping by.
All right. Thanks so much, Tom.
Good talking with you.
Yeah.
And you can read this over at gracelinks.org. Skip, we got a minute to the break. Skip in Miami, Florida, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Real quick, since we are short on time, I'd like to open a discussion about going back to appointing the Senate by the state's House of Representatives,
a way of circumventing. It was pretty damn corrupt when they did it before. That's why the populist movement pushed through the 19th Amendment, 17th Amendment, whatever it is that provides for direct election of the Senate.
Yeah, I realize that, but it's almost we're just as corrupt now with, what does it take, $50-100 million to run for a successful Senate campaign?
Yeah.
In a big
Yeah, but the solution isn't to throw the corruption from the national stage to a local stage where it might even be easier to hide and bury. The solution is to get rid of the corruption, to get money out of politics, to reverse Citizens United.
I absolutely agree with you. I just think this is comfortable with a short-term method.
Yeah, I don't think so, Skip. I think you'd be making things worse. But thanks for the call and toss entered into the pot. I know that there are some
some Tea Partiers who are pushing this big time. Let's go back to having the states, you know, decide who their senators are, as in state politicians that we can buy.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Check out our new video over at greenworldrising.org, by the way. I think you'll love it. Welcome back. Excuse me. Jim in Lompoc, California. Lompoc? How do you say it, Jim?
Lompoc.
Lompoc. Thank you. Watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is regarding the Constitution and amending the Constitution.
Right.
In particular, you and Bernie talk about money in the voting in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to see to review quickly so everybody understands what it takes to amend the Constitution, and then for you to give me a path on any subject that you think can get amended. The Constitution amended on in the politics, you know, the standing of politics nowadays, you know,
right.
Even in the future, it seems there'll never be a political culture that'll allow the amendment to happen on any subject, unless perhaps it benefits big corporation or big government.
Well, let's look at the 26th Amendment, because I think that's it's a useful lesson for us. The 26th Amendment was passed in 1971. It was introduced in the spring, and it was ultimately ratified by the fall or by the summer. I think it was July of 1971. And so it didn't take a very long period of time. And what that amendment does is it lowers the voting age from 21 to 18 nationwide. That amendment came about in large part. This was before the Nixon scandals. This was before Watergate. That all happened in late 72, early 73. This was directly a consequence of the Vietnam War. The young people were going off to die, and they couldn't vote on what they were dying about. Barry McGuire had this song, The Eve of Destruction, which was first rolled out in the late 60s, I think 66, 67. But by 71, this song had come back and hit number one on the Billboard charts. It was, you know, it was huge. And in that song, there was this line, you're old enough to die, but not for voting. And, you know, this old world is exploding, something, something, bodies floating, you're old enough to die, but not for voting. And, you know, and that was, you know, everybody in America got it. And there was this movement that really, I mean, you could argue that it built over the course of the Vietnam War, over 5-6 years, but it really, really took place in about a year and a half, and to lower the voting age. And it happened because the American electorate was aroused. People were really upset about this, and they wanted to do something about it. And what they were upset about, frankly, was the Vietnam War. And the only way that they could do something about it is they figured if they got young people to vote, those young people would vote in legislators who would end the war, which is what happened, by the way, to some extent.
Can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I hear you fine.
Okay. So you understand that the reason that got through is because every senator who had a son, every congressman who had a son, didn't want him going back to war. So it was easy to get the politics on the side of that one. The same with the 27th. But now in this culture, how do we go forward from here? You need 2/3 of the Congress, both houses. You need a president to sign it, and you need ratification from
Jim, back in 71, most senators and most members of Congress. I don't know if George Bush was a member of Congress at that time. I think he was. They could figure out ways to get their sons out of combat. It wasn't a problem, number one. And number two, right now, every member of Congress, Democrats, Republicans, both, have to spend 4, 5, 6 hours every single day dialing for dollars and raising money. And they all hate it. The only ones who are in favor of keeping the system as it is are people like Darrell Issa, who's got $700 million and can fund his own campaign. So I think we're at a similar time. It's talk media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Matt in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hi. I got something that Time Warner is trying to pull in Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
I logged on to C-SPAN earlier today, trying to do a streaming video or something.
Right.
And it came up, authorization required.
Right.
which I never seen before. So I punched in my authorization and Time Warner code and all that, and then it came up with a message. I can't remember exactly the phrasing, but the paraphrase is, you can't watch this video or the content on this screen. Contact Time Warner.
Okay.
So I contact Time Warner. I asked them, well, what's up with this? I can't view videos on C-SPAN. What's the deal? Oh, well, apparently their policy is if you don't I have internet and phone with them. That's
right.
All I have. If you don't have cable TV, then you can't watch that.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, that's ridiculous. You know, I pay you $40 a month for internet access. That means full internet access. That means anywhere I want to go, I should be able to go.
Right.
So I'm paying for. That, you know, they don't tell you you can get phone and internet for this price. Of course, there's restrictions on your internet. They don't tell you that.
Well, here's the rationale for what's going on, Matt. Let me give you the backstory. When cable companies, when cable started getting big in the United States back in the 70s or 80s, the cable companies were coming to city after city, country, state after state, and across the country, saying, we want access to the commons. We need to be able to dig up roads. We need to be able to dig up streets. We need to run our fiber, our cable lines on telephone poles. We need access to the commons, and we need city governments to do this and to help us do this. And the response was, if you are going to use our commons, you have to pay for that. And the way that the cable companies pay for it is they all pay a small tax that funds C-SPAN. C-SPAN, this public, the public access television, essentially, C-SPAN was the price that the cable companies paid for having access to the commons. Now, yes, they are using those commons to bring you, Time Warner is using that commons to bring you your telephone and your internet via presumably a coax cable that can also bring you cable TV. But it's the cable TV division slash function. Back then, the internet was not being, you know, being delivered by cable. It was mostly being delivered by telephone systems. And so it wasn't envisioned as part of the C-SPAN deal. So it's the cable TV carriers who are paying for C-SPAN, and so what they're saying to you is, if you don't pay for our cable TV, we're not going to pay for your C-SPAN.
Yeah, they're forcing you to get cable TV whether you want it or not.
That's right.
If you want to, if you want unrestricted access. Now, they're doing this on C-SPAN. I don't know what other websites they're doing it on.
I'm guessing it's just C-SPAN.
They're doing it on more websites.
Well,
and
you know,
they're going to do it on everything. You know, they're going to do it. I watch MSNBC website a lot. There's a show on there I like to watch. And, you know, what's to stop them from putting an authorization on that, too?
Oh, they will.
Yes. Yeah,
they
will. Sure they will. And then
they
can't, and they'll have it on every stinking website that you want to go to, all the major websites, you know, BBC or whatever. And your $40 a month that you're paying for internet access ain't worth squat.
Yeah.
Because you can't watch what you want to watch, and I thought that's what you were paying for on your internet access.
Yeah. Welcome to the brave new world of 8 or 10 corporations, and really 4 or 5 in a big way, controlling, you know, pretty much virtually everything that has to do with the world of both cable television and the internet. Matt, I don't have a solution for you. We've got a badly broken system. The FCC needs to explicitly state that under Title II of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, the internet is a common carrier. Internet carriers, people who provide internet services, are common carriers. I don't know if you saw the piece. I think it was in the New York Times last week about, you know, why is it that telephone service, internet service, all these things cost half as much in Europe, in some cases cost a fifth as much as in the United States. The reason why is because all the companies that deliver it to your house are required to rent basically that pipe out to anybody who wants to use it. So if you got Time Warner wire coming into your house, but you don't want to use Time Warner as your internet service provider, your ISP, instead you want to use Sovereignet or Acme or, you know, whatever, you can, in those countries, you can negotiate with that other independent company to be your deliverer of internet content, even though it's going over Time Warner's pipes, and they pay a small fee to Time Warner for rental. So the Time Warner's not losing money on maintaining those pipes. That's how it's done in most of the world. Here in the United States,
we have allowed these companies to get legislation passed and FCC policies passed through their lobbying that gives them absolute monopoly. If they've got a Time Warner wire coming into your house, they have you locked into Time Warner, and you have no choice. If you want AT&T, you have to get AT&T to run their wire into your house. And that's nuts. This is the third world way to do things, but that's how it's done in the United States. And you know, until enough people get really seriously PO'd about this and start showing up, and until we have some really serious anti-corruption laws, which, you know, now that the Supreme Court has legalized corruption and bribery at the political level, is going to be really tough without amending the Constitution. See our previous conversation. It's going to be a real challenge. So
I call them and express my dissatisfaction with their policy.
Yeah, that's going to do nothing.
A lot of people are going to be calling them.
Because what you're doing is you're calling them up and saying, I don't like it that you're making money, and they're just going to laugh all the way to the bank. The people that you need to be calling are your two senators in Ohio, and Sherrod Brown is all over this stuff, one of your senators. You need to call your two senators, and you need to call whoever represents you in the House of Representatives, and then you need to call your state senator and your state representative, and the mayor and whoever's your representative in your city council. You need to raise hell with all of those elected officials who directly represent you and for whom you can directly vote. That's where you start. That's the pressure point, Matt. And of course, like you're doing right now, make as much noise as you can in as many venues as you can. Write letters to the editor of your local newspaper. Call into other talk show hosts. Things like that. But, you know, I'm with you, man. Thanks a lot for the call. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And so far, you don't have to have cable to watch or listen to our program. It's free. It's over at TomHartman.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I'm going to pick up your calls in just a second, but I had to point out this over at addictinginfo.org. Pew poll. This is, Pew is reputable, nonpartisan, straight down the middle. Pew poll. Libertarians don't know what libertarian means. They say even those who voted for Bush twice and then both McCain and Romney claim that they're not Republicans. No, we're not Republicans anymore. We're now libertarians. Right. So what's a libertarian? Well, only 11% knew the official definition, the definition that the Libertarian Party itself puts out, which is that we are a libertarian is someone whose political views emphasize individual freedom by limiting the role of government. Now, let me point out this is an oxymoron. You are not free if you are not educated. Government provides free education. If you can't read and write, you're not anywhere near as free as somebody who can. So the whole libertarian mantra right from the get-go is an oxymoron. It makes no sense. It's cover for we want to be free, we billionaires want to be free to pollute the air with our factories. We want to be free to exploit our workers. We want to be free to stash our money in offshore bank accounts without consequences. We want to be free of taxation. We want to be free of having to pay for the commons that we use and that we pollute. That's what libertarianism really means. Smaller government? Sure. Yeah, we don't need no stinking EPA. We don't need no stinking FDA. You think I'm exaggerating? Listen to this. This is the political platform. You can find this over on Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov/Koch-brothers. David Koch ran for vice president of the United States against Ronald Reagan on the libertarian platform. Well, I guess he was running against George W. Bush as vice president. And here's the platform. We urge the repeal of federal campaign finance laws. The immediate abolition of the despotic Federal Election Commission. In other words, we want to be able to buy any damn politician we please. We favor the abolition of Medicare and Medicaid programs. In other words, you get sick, screw you, you're not a billionaire. We oppose any compulsory insurance or tax-supported plan to provide health services. Right. Yeah, it's a variation. You get sick, screw you, you're not a billionaire.
Something about Darwin in there, right? We also favor the deregulation of the medical insurance industry. Yeah, let them stick it to you. Let them drop your policy if you get sick. Let's deregulate them. Let them totally mess with people. Because billionaires don't even need health insurance companies. They get sick enough, they can buy a wing of a hospital. We also we favor the repeal of the fraudulent, virtually bankrupt, and increasingly oppressive Social Security system. Right. Let's take a $2.5 trillion trust fund and give it to the big banks. Think what they can skim off the top of that. We oppose, we propose the abolition of the governmental postal service. Oh my God, that agent of tyranny, the post office. The one agency, by the way, in the United States where you can send a communication and know that no one's going to read it without a court order. Google's reading your email. Microsoft's reading your email. Yahoo's reading your email. The post office is not reading your mail. Unless some judge has signed a warrant. Back to the Koch brothers, back to the Libertarian Party platform of 1980. We oppose all personal and corporate income taxation, including capital gains taxes. Yeah, we want to just take all the money. We don't want to have any responsibility for society. Screw society. We support the eventual repeal of all taxation. Right. Let's, you know, what little government we need, you know, the army or something, let's do it all with fees on consumption, right? Sales taxes. Hit the little guy. We support the, as an interim measure, all criminal and civil sanctions against tax evasion should be terminated immediately. Stop enforcing the IRS code. Right. You get it. You know, the average person, you know, most people actually get money back from the IRS. I don't know if it's most people, but it's I think it's Mitt Romney's 47%. They either get, you know, either they pay no federal income taxes or they actually get money back. The things like earned income child credit, things like that. Koch brothers wanted, we're going to do away with all that stuff. We support repeal of all laws which impede the ability of a person to find employment, such as minimum wage laws. No more minimum wage laws. Hey, how'd you like to work for $3 an hour? End all government education. We advocate the complete separation of education and state. Government ownership, operation, regulation, and subsidy of schools and colleges should be ended. Yeah, to hell with Thomas Jefferson and the University of Virginia. Screw Abraham Lincoln and the land-grant colleges. Those guys didn't know what they were talking about. That's not how you build a great country. You build a great country by only letting rich people go to college. We support the abolition of the Environmental Protection Agency. After all, our Georgia-Pacific plants making paper are dumping all kinds of crap into the waterways. We'd like to dump more crap. It would be more profitable. Our refineries are dumping all kinds of crap into the air. We'd like to dump more crap into the air. It'd be more profitable. We support the abolition of the Department of Energy. One wonders if they realized back then that the principal thing that the Department of Energy did was build nuclear bombs. I doubt it. We call for the dissolution of all government agencies concerned with transportation, including the Department of Transportation. Yeah, no more standards for our roads, no more standards for our railways, no more standards for our airlines. Well, just turn it all over to the billionaires. They can run it all. Right out of Galt's Gulch. We demand the return of America's railroad system to private ownership. We call for the privatization of the public roads in the national highway system. Yep, turn them all into toll roads. Let the billionaires buy them, and every time you want to go to, you got to drive to work on a highway? Hey, you're going to have to pay the Koch brothers. We specifically oppose laws requiring an individual to buy or use, quote, self-protection equipment, such as safety belts, airbags, or crash helmets. Because we want so many more people to show up in the ERs. Actually, it'll be a big boon to the privately owned hospitals now that we've done away with government health care. We advocate the abolition of the Federal Aviation Administration. Right. Let the billionaires run the skies. We advocate the, and they can charge whatever they want. And say United Airlines, oh, you're just carrying average working people? Your fees just went from a $100 landing slot to a $5,000 landing slot per use or whatever it is.
We advocate the abolition of the Food and Drug Administration. Billionaires don't have to worry about whether their food is safe. They can own their own farmland, have their own peasants working it. Know that it's safe. Have their own little slaughterhouse. I mean, you know, that's for the little people, right? Food and Drug Administration, knowing that the drugs are safe. I mean, billionaires can buy their drugs from Switzerland, where you know that your drugs are safe. We support an end to all subsidies for childbearing built into our present laws, including all welfare plans and the provision of tax-supported services for children. Screw children. Who needs children? We don't need no stinking kids. After all, poor people having children, it just makes more poor people. Only billionaires should be allowed to reproduce, or at least encouraged to reproduce. We oppose all government welfare relief projects and, quote, aid to the poor, end quote, programs. All these government programs are privacy-invading, paternalistic, demeaning, and inefficient. The proper source of help for such persons is the voluntary effort of private groups and individuals. Yes, turn poverty over to the rich people. They've always done such a good job of taking care of poor people. Haven't you noticed? Look at all those homeless people that the Koch brothers let sleep on their front lawn. Oh, they don't? Well, how about the clinic that the Koch brothers are running out of the front of their mansions for poor people? Oh, they don't? The soup kitchens that they don't? Okay, we call for the privatization of the inland waterways and of the distribution center that brings water to industry, agriculture, and households. Yes, let's let the billionaires own our water. You can trust them. They just want to make a small profit. We call for the repeal of the Occupational Safety and Health Act. Right. Workers don't need protections. We're employers. We'll protect our workers. Look at we have a long history of doing that. Don't Google Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. There've been a few problems, you know, the Ludlow slaughter. But you know, you can trust us now. We've become nice people. We call for the abolition of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Right, because kids should be able to swallow things that they can choke on. It'll weed out more of the poor people. Kill off their babies? I mean, sure. And we support the repeal of all state usury laws. Usury laws are laws that don't let banks rip you off by charging obscenely high interest rates. Usury is a biblical word. No, we're falling on the side of the banksters. Let's screw the average person. Billionaires don't need banksters to borrow money from. We invest money in the banks. So, poor peasants who need to borrow money, you need to borrow money for your mortgage? Hey, screw you. We're the billionaires. This is the official party platform in 1980 on which David Koch ran for Vice President of the United States. Give you any clues as to what libertarianism really means?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Now that I've got that rant out of my system, back to your calls. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And there's my cursor. Eric in, and it doesn't, I'm talking computer cursor. Eric in High Springs, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Okay, great, great. Thanks, Tom. I just want to comment about the Burger King merger with the Canadian company.
Yeah.
There's just been no word from anybody, probably besides your channel, that what are all these extra profits? Where are they going to go? They're definitely not going to go to the minimum wage workers. Just like you were saying, there is a real war being waged on poor people in this country. A lot of middle class people have gone down to the lower class in the past decade. I call it the great dumbing down of American society. Yeah. But there's a real trick to getting the poor person to vote Republican, because the Republicans don't want the poor person to have increase in minimum wage. They don't want poor people to have health care. They don't want women to have control over their reproductive rights. They don't want you to vote. They don't want you to breathe clean air or drink clean water. So there's a real war going on. So how do you get the person who makes $20,000 a year to vote for the Republicans, who are definitely not working for you or me, how do you get them to vote Republican?
You wake them up.
Well, Fox News has a lot of divergence going on in their program. So if you could just infiltrate the poor people with a lot of hatred and divide them against their
neighbors. Talking about what their strategy is to keep people voting against their own best interests.
Yeah, how right. do you get the person who makes minimum wage to vote against their best self-interest?
Right. You use what are called wedge issues. You get them freaked out about black people or brown people or women or abortion or pot smokers or communists or, you know, you name it, right? Whatever people are most afraid of, that's what Republicans will be all over. They're all about making you afraid.
And you keep them in their own, you keep them in their own society. You keep them in their own closed society. You put right. programs on TV like Duck Dynasty that appeals to these poor Southerners. So they're happy to wallow in their own ways. The rich people have contempt for poor people. The rich people are afraid of poor people. When the poor people rise up and make a decent salary, then the government itself is challenged. There is no way this country will ever succeed when the majority of the population is going south, going towards the poverty. And I'm not going to be voting for Hillary Clinton because through no fault of Mr. Clinton's, through no fault of his own, he lost the Southern vote before he even stepped into the White House in 92. The Clintons are just too divisive. If Joe Biden's not going to be running, I'm going to be voting for Bernie Sanders, and hopefully he'll get Elizabeth Warren on his ticket. And I just want to say that Burger King deal.
Yeah. I think a Sanders Warren ticket could actually win. I really do. I really think we're at that moment in history where a Sanders Warren ticket could win. Eric, thanks for the call. And your wide ranging rant, spot on. We'll be right back. Minutes before the hour, Tom Harbin here with you, the place where despair is not an option. Just a quick reminder, in 15 minutes, Senator Bernie Sanders will be joining us for the next hour, our Brunch with Bernie hour. So we will be clearing the lines at the top of this hour and, get ready if you've got calls for Senator Sanders. We're doing a Brunch with Bernie a day early. Today is Thursday. Ken in Sarasota Springs, New York. New York. Hey, Ken, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? Saratoga Springs.
Sorry.
Well, I've been listening, and there's so many comments I'd like to make. I did want to comment about Tom. Before I really comment, let me explain something. I'm 70. I'm a white man. I'm a Christian man. I really believe in my Christian beliefs. Can you just tell me who you are?
Who I am?
Yes. A little bit of your, just like I gave you my bio, my little bit of my bio. Can you describe yourself?
Yeah.
So I understand who I'm talking to.
Sure. I'm not going to do that, Ken. I don't think that I can easily categorize myself.
Not a problem. Okay. As a Christian man, I'm progressive. Christian people are very progressive, believe it or not.
No, I do believe it. I call myself a Christian.
Not in the way a lot of progressive people want to call progressive parties, but we believe in charity. We believe in helping people. And I can't understand, my whole time growing up, I watched us go from a local to a state to a country. And we are evolving. The human race is really evolving to a world government. So all these things that we talk about in our country, like we should have jobs, we should have this, all that 1% people that I hear you talking about, They're interested in the whole world. They want peace. They want the world. And you're right. They don't care. And they're working for that world government. And most progressives seem like they want to. And I understand that, but they've got to realize what they're going to get. The same thing goes with...
I don't think most progressives want a one-world government. I think most Americans, and I think this is true of every country on Earth, most people have a good, strong streak of nationalism in them, and it's my country first, right? And then we'll deal with the rest of the world. And that's a very strong tenet of progressive,
my country first,
progressive ideologies. America first.
Right? If it is my country first, I will just take the immigration issue in this country. Now, before any of this immigration thing happened here, I'll go back 10 years. Before any of that happened, did the United States have an immigration policy?
We've had I've got 4 minutes left with the show. I've got 10 people on hold, and we are wandering into long, in-depth. I'm sorry, Ken. We'll have this conversation another time when we've got more time for it. It really does deserve more time. Don in Lakeport, California. You want to talk about fish and mercury?
Yeah. On the salmon, you're talking about mercury in them.
Yeah.
Salmon have a short lifespan of about 2 years, so to build up any kind of mercury.
So they're fast growth. So that's why they're not accumulating mercury. Also.
Yeah. It's a wild fish, as opposed to a catfish who sits in a lake somewhere for 20 years. So eat young fish.
Okay. Excellent point. Thanks, Don, for that. Robert in Carnegie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Robert.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. I just want to throw out an idea that surfaced. You hear about our welfare state and people on welfare and so forth. But would there be any credence if we had, like, a community service that you had to participate in prior to receiving any type of government assistant programs?
Well, here's the problem with that, Robert. Most of the people in the United States, the numeric majority, more than 50% of all the people in the United States who are getting some kind of welfare benefits are either children, elderly, or disabled people.
Okay.
So I don't think you're going to say to a six-year-old, sorry, you got to go to work in the mills. You're not going to say to somebody who's quadriplegic.
I'm saying is, let's say at age 15, that, like, for example, a single mother who may have to spend most of her time, working a job or two jobs. So then if that is the case, you would have people who would, do their X amount of community service for 100 hours.
But Robert, your assumption, your statement assumes that being a mom is not a job. We have not valued motherhood or fatherhood, for that matter, in this country ever. Other countries do. Other countries, you actually, in most Northern European countries, if you're a stay-at-home mom or a stay-at-home dad, you are considered as contributing to their equivalent of Social Security. You get a pension based on that. It's considered work. I think that, if you want to deal with poverty and welfare programs, I think a simple way to do it is to do what Alaska's doing and expand it slightly. Have a guaranteed minimum income. Everybody in the country gets a minimum income and enough to keep them out of poverty. And there are countries that do this. Norway does this. Most of the oil-rich countries of the Middle East do this. And in Qatar, it's over $100,000 a year. I'm not suggesting that much, but just a guaranteed minimum income. Something that was proposed, by the way, by Thomas Paine back in the 1790s. Maureen in San Diego, California, we got less than a minute. It's yours.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about a CNN iReport that went up about a week ago, and it's got about 500,000 views and maybe 150,000 shares, and yet CNN is not reporting on it. It's about a CDC whistleblower who's come out and saying that he fraudulently changed research that he had done 10 years ago.
On vaccine, on MMR vaccine and autism. Yeah. I've read it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I thought it was a worthy story that people should know about.
Yeah, it is. And you just brought it to everybody's attention. Good on you, Maureen. Thank you very much. There's a lot of this stuff is still out there. or is still up in the air. I think measles, mumps, and rubella should be split out instead of being all three vaccines being given at the same time. I think they should be given separately. But that's just my opinion, and I'm not a doctor. Anyhow, we'll be back. Bernie, up next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. It's Thursday, but we will be, we are right now live going to do brunch with Bernie today instead of tomorrow. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us live from South Carolina. Senator, South Carolina?
South Carolina. How are you, Tom?
I'm great. I hope you are well.
I am well. It is hot here in Columbia, South Carolina. Yesterday, I was in North Carolina in the morning and am very grateful, received the Patriots Award from the American Legion for work that I did along with Congressman Jeff Miller on the recently passed Veterans Bill, which will pump some $17 billion into health care improvements for America's veterans. So I was very honored to have received that award. And then last night in Raleigh, North Carolina, we had a wonderful event. We had about 300 people out to talk about the important issues facing our country. And this afternoon, I was earlier in right here in Columbia, where we held a rally on the need to expand Medicaid for all. South Carolina is one of those states which has not accepted the Affordable Care Act's willingness to expand Medicaid. In this case, it means 300,000 people in South Carolina will not get health insurance who otherwise would at no cost to the state of South Carolina. And tonight we're going to do an event here as well, and tomorrow we go on to Mississippi. So we're on the road. It's something I enjoy doing, and the reason I do it is I believe in my heart of hearts that we are not a blue state or a red state. But I believe that on most of the important issues facing the middle class and working families of this country, there is, in fact, widespread agreement. And I think one of the problems is progressives have turned their backs on many, many states in this country, and it's about time we get into those states, start educating, start organizing, start increasing voter turnout, because I think there are a lot of people who are hurting in these states who really need government to start working for them. So that's why I'm here.
Yeah, that's marvelous. And what do you see as the summer is rolling along and we're getting closer and closer to going back to Congress, going back? Mitch McConnell has come out and said that if he becomes the Senate Majority Leader, he's going to attach riders to every single bill that'll basically force Obama to shut down the government. Your thoughts on all that?
Well, it's not surprising. It's just another overreach. These guys have been playing obstructionist politics from the day Barack Obama was elected. They said no to any significant legislation which will improve the lives of working families. They have run up a record-breaking number of filibusters. So it doesn't surprise me at all that that's what McConnell will say. What our job is now in the remaining months that we have before the election, I think the entire election is going to hinge on voter turnout. It's as simple as all that. What the Koch brothers, who are pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into these elections, want, what Mitch McConnell wants, what the Republicans want, is a low voter turnout. They want people not to participate in the political process, not to stand up and fight for their rights. What the pundits tell us, Tom, is that the projection is that about 60% of the American people are not going to vote in November. And if that happens, I would say there's a pretty good likelihood the Republicans will gain control over the Senate, because that means that the vast, overwhelming 70, 80% of low-income working people are not going to be voting. People of color are not going to be voting. Young people are not going to be voting. And all of that works to benefit Republicans. If we can increase that voter turnout from 40 to 50%, I mean, which is not certainly a revolutionary development here, half of the people voting, my guess is the Democrats would do very, very well in the Senate, maybe even gain some seats and probably regain control over the House. But what we have got to do is reach out to people who are disillusioned with the political process, who are not registered to vote, who really don't know much about what's going on, and make them understand that these are life and death issues for them in terms of what we're dealing with. Are people going to have health care or are they not? Are their jobs going to go to China? Or are we going to get companies to reinvest in America? Are we going to raise the minimum wage so that people don't have to live in abject poverty when they're working 40 hours a week? Are we going to make higher education affordable and reduce interest rates for those students who are carrying significant debt right now? Are we going to move toward pay equity for women so they're not getting 70 or 75 cents on the dollar of what men are getting? Are we going to address the issue of climate change and cut carbon emissions and move to energy efficiency and sustainable energies? These are the issues that are right there on the table. And if working people and lower-income people do not participate, if the Koch brothers are successful in electing candidates whose sole interest is to make the rich richer, this country is going to be in very, very difficult straits.
And Mitch McConnell in this conference sponsored by the Koch brothers, where he and Joni Ernst and a bunch of others were, you know, kissing the shoes, I guess, of these billionaires. He said, this is from The Nation, they have a transcript of it, quote, "The worst day of my political life was when President George W. Bush signed McCain-Feingold into law in the early part of his administration. All Citizens United did was to level the playing field for corporate speech. We now have, I think, the most free and open system we've had in modern times. The Supreme Court allowed all of you," he's speaking to the billionaires, "to participate in the process in a variety of different ways. You can give to the candidate of your choice, you can give to Americans for Prosperity, or something else, a variety of different ways to push back against the party of government."
Well, Mitch McConnell is being very honest. He has, in fact, been one of the leaders. I think he provided a friend of the court statement in support of Citizens United. What he understands, and it's exactly what he said, he can translate a little bit into English, but what he basically said is, look, what I, Mitch McConnell, believe is that billionaires should be able to control the political process. And for him, what freedom is about is the ability of the Koch brothers and other billionaires to spend as much money as they want to elect people like Mitch McConnell and others, whose job it is then to represent the people who fund their campaigns. That's their definition of freedom. Now, I want to say on that issue that the vast majority of the American people, whether they're Republicans, moderates, independents, Democrats, disagree with Mitch McConnell. They understand that what Citizens United is about is allowing billionaires to undermine American democracy. They do not see the ability to buy elections as free speech. And as I hope most listeners know, within, I suspect, the month, I'm not quite sure, or 6 weeks, there will be legislation on the floor of the Senate, which I helped write, which will be a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. And there is no issue that I can think of that is more important than that. Because no matter what you're concerned about, whether you're concerned about health care or education or the need for job creation or global warming or foreign policy, whatever it may be, tax reform, all of those issues are impacted by Citizens United. Because what the Koch brothers are doing right now is breaking all precedent in the amounts of money, not only the money that they're spending in campaigns, but all of the organizations that they have funded. So every night there's another guy on television from some organization, and people don't know it, that's an organization funded by the Koch brothers. It is a very radical attempt to move this country in an extremely reactionary way. And one of the things that I get very bothered about, you know, the media, corporate media will talk about, well, yes, the Koch brothers are spending a whole lot of money, but they don't really talk about what these guys stand for. And what we know is that back in 1980, David Koch ran for vice president of the United States on the Libertarian Party. And we have their platform. And if people want it, they can go to my website, sanders.senate.gov. We have it there. It's very clear what these guys stand for. And this is, you know, what they stand for is repealing all campaign finance law, ending Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, ending the concept of the minimum wage, et cetera, et cetera.
It's pretty radical.
It is very radical.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. He'll be taking your calls right after the break in our national town hall meeting a day early here on the Tom Hartman Program, Brunch with Bernie. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov. Facebook, you can easily find it. And welcome back. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona, watching on Free Speech TV. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator Sanders. I urge you to run as a Democrat in the upcoming election, and you will. I guarantee you will open up so many eyes in the debates. It'll be great. Now, the question I have for you is: after taking office, hopefully, and I think you will, would you consider reinstating the fairness doctrine in relation to the media? And I thank you, sir, and I'll take your answer off air.
Well, Steve, let me tell you this. I believe that one of the very serious problems facing our country is the degree to which huge media conglomerates own and control what the American people see, hear, and read. And I'm not just talking about Fox, and I'm not just talking about the fact that some 95% of talk radio, I mean, we cherish Tom Hartman because Tom is one of the few out there who is presenting us with a progressive and alternative point of view, because 95% of talk radio is extreme right-wing or extreme right-wing, and is sponsored by, you know, these large companies who want the American people to hear that. So what I will tell you, Steve, is that the idea, in one way or another, I'm not exactly sure the best way to do it, but certainly we have got to break this monopoly that corporate America has on the media, and we need other points of view. And what drives me nuts is the fact that on virtually every important issue facing the American people, there is far too little discussion. So if it's not an important issue, the media will spend weeks on it. If it's an important issue, we'll have relatively little discussion. Every poll that I have seen tells me that jobs are the top of the agenda for what the American people want. Real unemployment is 12%. Youth unemployment, 20%. African American youth unemployment, 35%. It seems to me this is a discussion that we should be having day after day after day. How do we create the millions of decent paying jobs? Do you hear that discussion terribly often on TV or radio? Not really. Trade policy, which, by the way, was developed by both Republicans and Democrats. We have lost some 50, 60,000 factories in the last 15 years, a lot of it because of disastrous trade policies that allow these companies to shut down in America, move to China. Steve, you hear a whole lot of discussion on TV about our disastrous trade policies? I don't think so. Inequality and the fact that the rich are getting richer at the expense of everybody else, you do hear it occasionally, but nowhere near the degree that we should be focusing on it. So, yes, Steve, I think how we deal with the concentration of ownership in media is a huge issue, and one that I certainly think has to be dealt with.
Yeah, it's including by the Sherman Act, right?
Yes, I do think so, yes. So instead of seeing more media mergers, we should see more diversity in the media for sure.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you. We're going to hit a break in just like 2 seconds here. So,
Okay, well, I think Steve asked a very, very important question. And anyone who wants to change this country is going to have to do a lot of thinking about understanding about how people get the information they get, why we talk about certain issues, and why we don't talk about other issues.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us, our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, a day early here Thursday in our third hour. We'll We'll be back with your calls to Senator Sanders right after this. Past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, a day early. Senator Sanders taking your calls. Amy in Madison, Wisconsin. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, Tom and Bernie, I have good news.
Okay.
The Department of Vocational Rehabilitation contacted two local brothers who are small businessmen, and sometimes back the Republicans are giving me a chance at their grocery store to work.
That's great.
Congratulations, Amy. Best of luck to you.
Amy,
yeah, it's different than the Koch brothers.
Yeah. Did you have a question for Bernie, Amy, or did you just want to share the good news?
I just wanted to say that the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation really helps the disabled.
That's great. Well,
that is great.
Amy, thank you.
Congratulations, and good luck on your job.
Amen. Lisa in Huntington Beach, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator. I was wondering, do you think progressives may be alienating working class and maybe middle class Americans when, in the name of the environment, they impose measures that end up hitting working people in the pocketbook, even if that's not the intention, like cap and trade, gas may go up at the pump, bus fare may go up, they take away our plastic bags and make us buy bags, all these things that just hit working people the hardest, and they're intended to encourage conservation. Maybe they do, or maybe we're already conserving as much as we can if we're struggling. These things just hit working people in the pocketbook.
Okay,
and
well,
I,
Lisa, let me respond by saying this. I do understand where you're coming from. That's what the Republicans, that's the line that the Republicans push. They say, oh, well, if you're concerned about global warming, that's going to mean more economic adversity and hardship for working families. I believe two things. Number one, Lisa, in terms of global warming, we are, according to the scientific community, and there's no longer a debate about it, we are facing a global crisis which must be addressed. No alternatives. And that means that we have got to move away from fossil fuel energy efficiency and to such sustainable energies as wind, solar, geothermal, and others. And if we do not significantly reduce carbon emissions, if the planet continues to warm, if our oceans continue to warm, our kids and our grandchildren are going to be living in an uninhabitable or a world in which things are going to be very, very difficult. We're already seeing, you know, the kinds of drought that California is experiencing. We've seen a whole lot of flooding, extreme weather disturbances, major changes in the oceans, and so forth and so on. So I think this is an issue we have to deal with. Now, the question is, how do you deal with it in a way that does not adversely impact working people, and the ways that you can do it? Senator Barbara Boxer and I introduced a major global warming bill, which called for a tax on carbon. But what we also did is raised huge sums of money, which we plow right back into the pockets of working people, so that if their costs go up, they are covered as a result of that. Also, when you transform the energy system and you move to weatherization and you move to energy efficiency, we have the potential to create a significant number of new jobs. So I think we can design public policy that reverses global warming, that protects the environment, but also protects and in some cases improves lives for working families.
Kevin in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening to KTRC 1260. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Bernie.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask Senator Sanders if he would sponsor a bill that would give lapel cams and dash cams to every police department in the United States to help cut down on these killings and these, like in Ferguson, because it's known that having the lapel cam or having the dash cam, the guy did have a dash cam, can cut down on these types of incidents. But also, if they are going to be wielding the power of life and death, over our fellow citizens. I think that there should be documentation of what happens.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, Kevin. A number of years ago, I got some money, I believe it was for the Sheriff's Department in Vermont, for videotape cameras to be placed in police cars. So the idea of having cameras to record the work of police officers does make sense to me, and I think you're right. It'll make officers more conscious about how they are behaving. I think that makes sense.
Janet in Kathleen, Georgia. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Yes, good afternoon, Senator and Professor. Thank you so much for taking my call. My question has to do with the War Powers Act. The president sent military advisors to Iraq in June of this year. It's my understanding that Congress has the right of approval or disapproval within 60 days, and there's been no vote.
The answer is that the War Powers Act means that the United States Congress must give approval or support if the president takes military action. I think, Janet, the question is, what do we define by military action? In my view, the president has the executive authority to initiate, for example, airstrikes. I don't think he needs the approval of Congress. Certainly, if we are going to be putting troops in any significant way in harm's way, if we're going to put combat troops back on the ground in Iraq or any place else, he does need the approval of the United States Congress, and that's something that I would strongly oppose. I think right now in Iraq you have a very, very difficult situation. I think the response has got to be not just the United States but international, and I think we can have some real military impact along with other countries without getting our troops back on the ground and in harm's way. And that would be my position.
And we have what, Shane? Oh, here's the break. He said 3 seconds. I thought he said 30 seconds. Perfect timing, Senator. We will be back with more of your questions for Senator Bernie Sanders in just a moment as we do our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders a day early here today in our third hour of our program. Yes, we are live. It's Thursday. It's our third hour, 2:28 Eastern time. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. And you can check out our new video at greenworldrising.org. Senator Sanders is in it. Welcome back, Tom. Bernie Sanders on the line with us, our Brunch with Bernie hour, a day early. And John in Northville, New York, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, thank you for taking my call. And, Tom, I appreciate your program immensely. It's enlightening to have your take on everything. And, Bernie, Senator Bernie, I have a question. In all fairness, as they do in athletics, for instance, and running our homes, we put a cap on we have to manage our spending. Mm-hmm. Why can't we put a cap on all elections, especially major ones, where the people that are running will only have so much money to spend? In all fairness, they'll be able to learn how to spend our money and do our business for us. Thank you.
Well, thank you, John, for that important question. I don't know that that's going to be a mechanism to learn how to do good budgeting for the government, but I think in terms of the electoral process, you are absolutely right, which is why I believe very much we should move toward public funding of elections. What we have right now is a campaign finance system that is a disaster. I think at the beginning of the show, Tom was quoting what Mitch McConnell was saying. He loves the current system. In fact, he wants to go further. He wants to remove all restrictions on campaign finance so the Koch brothers can directly give Republican candidates tens and tens of millions of dollars and don't have to worry about independent expenditures. But what John is talking about is moving toward public funding of elections. I think that's what he's talking about. And what that means is if you can show, you want to run for governor of New York, you want to run for senator of Vermont, whatever, if you could show that you have strong support and get a significant numbers of small donations, then you will be able to get public funding to run, but there will be a cap on what you can spend. And some states already have that provision, and I think it works pretty well. Bottom line here is that democracy is not supposed to be about wealthy individuals or candidates supported by big business and billionaires outspending opponents by 10 to 1. And what you have now is it is increasingly difficult for a middle-class person who is not beholden to wealthy and corporate interest to run for office. So I do believe very strongly in public funding of elections. The immediate task in terms of campaign finance reform, overturn Citizens United. Secondly, we have to move to public funding of elections. And when you do that and start electing candidates who are not wealthy or beholden to the wealthy, I think you're going to see a real change in what government does for working people.
James in Spokane, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. James in Spokane, Washington.
Yeah, Tom, good evening, gentlemen. Good afternoon. Sorry, I was just brushing my teeth.
Okay. Your question for Bernie?
Yeah, let me set this up first. Using your terms, the big picture, Tom. My take on the global economy and the oligarchs is we've reached peak oil. They become vastly wealthy. They want some oil left for they and theirs. I think they want us cowed, corralled, or dead, fleeced and deceased. Are they not attempting to call the herd, so to speak?
Well, I wouldn't look at it exactly that way, but this is what I would tell you, James. And this is really quite incredible. When we talk about income and wealth inequality in America, where the top 1% owns about 38% of the wealth, the bottom 60% own all of 2.3% of the wealth, where 95% of all new income is going to the top 1%, internationally, globally, what you're looking at is 85 of the wealthiest people in this country own more wealth than the bottom half of the world's population. I think that's what, about 3 billion people, Tom?
It'd be about 3.5 billion people.
Yeah. So you got 85 people. You got 85 people into a kind of small room. They will own more wealth than 3.5 billion people. So what we see in the United States in terms of the growth of income and wealth inequality is an international phenomenon. And that's what one of the manifestations of globalism is about, globalization, is that fewer and fewer people are owning more and more of the resources and the wealth and the income of the world. And how you address that issue, how you create a global economic system by which we improve the lives of the poorest people rather than exploit them. Why we create decent-paying jobs for middle-class people throughout the industrialized world. That is the challenge of our time, and how you do all of that while fighting back and trying to reverse climate change, that is where we are right now. And it's going to require political struggle in countries all over the world to start putting people into office who are representing ordinary people rather than just the ruling classes of their own country. So it is a huge task. But the problem that we're seeing in terms of income and wealth inequality is not just an American issue. It is most certainly an international issue.
Fred in Woodruff, Wisconsin. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom and Senator Sanders. I'm a 75-year-old Vietnam-era Air Force vet. And I have a question about VA policy. I'm very satisfied with the VA here, and the Rhinelander has a satellite clinic of Iron Mountain, Michigan. Fantastic service. But I had a procedure done up in Iron Mountain that was an abdominal scan, and it was required by the vet, or recommended by the vets. And I have a question about the policy of the VA. When I called out, they said that they do not. I'm also on Medicare,
yep.
And I have a supplemental, and I got a bill for this procedure, and I called the VA, and they're great. They said, well, the policy is if Medicare does not cover it, they will not forward it to my supplemental policy. So, and I called my supplemental policy, and they said they would pay it if it could be forwarded. So there's a catch-22 here.
Thank you for the question. And it's an ongoing concern that we hope to rectify within the VA. It can save the VA money. And you've touched on an issue that our committee is, in fact, working on. So thank you very much for the question.
Kurt in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Kurt.
Hey, I just want you to know, if I get to my question, I just want you to know I love you like the uncle I've never had. And if you do decide to run for president, I know where I can find some surplus minibuses for auction, and I will pick up at least one of them and make sure everybody in my neighborhood gets to the polls. Get run for president.
Thank you very much, Kurt.
Yeah, I almost picked up one last week, $4,000 for a 2005 Aero Elite 290. See, 33 people.
Not bad at all.
Picked it up.
So what's your question,
yeah,
Kurt?
I almost picked it up. Well, my question is, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I talked to you about developing some sort of government declaration seal of approval, you know, something that would be a pro-good corporation type of thing so people can seek out corporations that support the local economy, that pay their taxes and do other things.
Right.
I was wondering how that comes
Bernie's along. Got it. Okay. Let's ask it.
Well, Kurt asked a very good question. And the essence of the question is, we know that there are corporations in this country who are profitable in America, but who shut down here, moved to China because they could make even more money. We have seen recently and in the past companies who are moving their headquarters abroad in order to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. And I think what Kurt is talking about is, why don't we develop policies which penalize those companies who are deserting our country and the people of our country? And why don't we reward those companies who are doing the right thing by paying people decent wages, by reinvesting in America, by paying their taxes in this country? And I think he is exactly right. And there are a number of pieces of legislation which address that issue in various ways. But I think Kurt is absolutely on to something. The idea that we give tax breaks to companies that shut down and move abroad, or give corporate welfare to similar type companies, makes no sense to me at all.
Sam in Woodstock, Illinois. Quick question for Bernie. We got about a minute and a half here.
Hey, is it possible to demilitarize the police without a buyback program? And is it possible to even pass the buyback program and or just disarm them at all, considering how armed our civilians are?
Well, I think this issue of, obviously, the militarization of police departments around the country has come to a fore as a result of Ferguson. And I think what people saw there has made a whole lot of people very, very uncomfortable. So I think when Congress reconvenes, I think there's going to be a lot of discussion, and I will support the demilitarization of police departments. At the end of the day, a good police department is one that is integrated into the community, where people feel that the police department is there working for them. They feel comfortable with the police officers, not a situation in which people perceive a police department to be an occupying entity. And that gives off all of the wrong signals. So I think there is a lot to be learned from Ferguson, and one of the lessons is demilitarization of police departments.
We'll be back with more of your questions for Senator Sanders in our Brunch with Bernie Hour in just a moment. Be sure to check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. And also you can check out the new video that we've done, narrated by Leonardo DiCaprio, starring in part Senator Bernie Sanders. It's over at greenworldrising.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And while we're talking about websites, we just completely reinvented ours, too. TomHartman.com just completely got rebooted from the ground up. Check it out. Welcome back. Joel in Temple, Georgia, watching Free Speech TV on cable. Hey, Joel, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. And to Senator Bernie Sanders, I really appreciate hearing you on TV when I see you on the floor. My question is, I was on a VRAP program. Are you familiar with that?
I am. Give me a hint.
That's the program that...
It's the Veterans Rehabilitation Program that was going through the unemployment for veterans who wanted to go back to school.
Yep, of course.
They only gave it to us for 12 months, and I was wondering why didn't they extend it for 2 years for 24 months, because the colleges, if you go to college, it takes more than a year to go to college.
Joel, I won't swear to you, because I don't have the paper in front of me, but if my memory is correct, that is exactly what we tried to do in some legislation to extend the VRAP program. What we did manage to do in the recent piece of veterans legislation that was passed is a very good thing, and that is to make in-state tuition available to all veterans. A lot of veterans move around, and they were forced to pay out-of-state tuition, which could mean many, many thousands of dollars so they couldn't go to school. So we addressed that educational issue. But the issue that you raise, if I am not mistaken, I won't swear to you, but I think it is something that we did try to do. We weren't successful, but it's still on the agenda, exactly what you're talking about.
You know, if I was really cynical, Senator, I'd say that the giving people 1 year of college when, you know, most basic degrees require two or arguably four is just feeding them into a system where the second year they're going to get a huge loan and the banksters are going to make out and the for-profit colleges are going to make out.
Yeah.
What do you think?
All I can say, Tom, is that one of the very important pieces of legislation passed in recent years was the post 9/11 GI educational bill. And the result of that is that, again, if my memory is correct, I don't have the figures in front of me, I think about 1 million veterans from the post 9/11 era or their family members are now going to college. Yeah. And that's a very big deal. What we did also put into this recent piece of legislation, something that I wanted very much, is that the widows of men who or women who were lost in war in Iraq and Afghanistan, they will now be able to take advantage of the GI, the post 9/11 GI educational bill. So you're going to see a lot of folks, mostly women, now being able to go to college or go to graduate school on that bill, which I think is exactly the right thing to have done.
That is absolutely great. We just have 30 seconds to the break, Senator. Anything you want to riff on?
Well, just staying on the vets issue, I just talked to a veteran today right here in South Carolina who told me that the care that he is getting is very, very good. What we are doing right now in terms of focusing on VA health care is to make sure the quality is strong, but equally important, to make sure that when people apply to get into the VA health care system, they can do that in a timely manner. And one of the ways we're doing that is by putting $5 billion into seeing the VA hire new doctors, nurses, and other medical personnel so they'll be able to better serve veterans in a timely manner.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with more of your questions, your calls for Senator Sanders right after this. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Brunch with Bernie a day early. Senator Sanders taking your calls. Eric in Tacoma, Washington. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, how's it going, Tom? Senator Sanders. As we all know, Senator, the purchasing power of the United States dollar is in kind of decline. And I was wondering what you think of states such as Utah passing legislation to make American Eagle silver and American Eagle gold coins as legal tender to purchase goods and services.
Eric, you'll have to forgive me on that one. I really have not done a lot of thinking or reading about it.
Ken, in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. How are you? This is Mike.
Good.
I'm Ken. Hey, by the way, Tom, loved the Crash 2016. Incredible.
Thank you.
Bernie, I had a question for you. Congress members are, I guess you'd say, public servants. They're supposed to be people that represent the people. When I do the numbers real quick, I come up to somewhere around $177 an hour or so that a Congress member makes. I'm wondering what would happen and how could it happen that we could make senators and or Congress's pay equal to the median income of the people they serve. And the reason why I say that is it would, as well as, of course, you know, bring in more of the common folk like me into Congress, so to speak, but it would also incentivize people in Congress to raise pay in their states, therefore being able to raise their own pay. I was just wondering what your thought was on that.
Well, that's an interesting concept. I don't know that I have thought about it too much. I think one of, you know, I think a lot of people are appropriately angry and frustrated with Congress. But the effort to lower congressional benefits, I know I sound a little self-serving here, but to lower them, the end result of that might well be that you'll even have more wealthier people. I mean, some people say, shouldn't pay members of Congress anything, hey, zero or $10 a week. And the end result of that would mean that the only people who would serve would be very, very wealthy, and you would end up with a House of Lords. So I think at the end of the day, the only way that I really know that you make Congress respond to the needs of working people is by electing people who are going to do the right thing and by holding them accountable. And that really speaks most significantly to campaign finance reform. So long as folks like the Koch brothers and other billionaires are able to elect the candidates of their choice, you're going to have a Congress and governors around this country who are far more interested in the needs of the wealthy and powerful than ordinary people. And I think, second of all, if you want a responsive governor or legislature in your own state, the issue we talked about a moment ago in terms of public funding of elections would be a step in the right direction.
Donald in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hi, Bernie. I was just a quick question. If we don't take the Senate, we don't take the House, and we do get a Democratic president and a vice president, where does that leave us? I mean, is that president going to be a nothing but a lame duck for the next 4 years? I'll let you take it from there.
Well, it's, you know, obviously it's going to tie the hands in a very significant way. If the Republicans, and we're talking about right-wing Republicans, control the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, clearly the president can veto legislation. But as I think Tom was talking about earlier, you know, Mitch McConnell has some ideas about how he can put riders into legislation so that if the president vetoes that, he could be accused of shutting down the government and doing other quote-unquote terrible things. So I think it would be a disaster for this country. It would put the president on the defensive 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we have got to do everything that we possibly can to make sure that that does not happen. And that speaks to voter turnout. The Republicans win when people do not come out to vote. The Republicans lose when there are large voter turnouts. Our job is to make sure that there are big voter turnouts.
Gus in Deerfield, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. In light of everything that's gone on or not gone on in the last 6 years, I'd like to see what you think about the idea of eliminating our elected officials, not the government completely. We still need the government, but eliminate the elected officials and allow the people to vote the issue. So they could set up some kind of national registry for voting and let the people decide whether they want immigration or whatever the other issue is, and eliminate the lining of the pockets of the elected officials who refuse to do what the people want.
Okay, and Bernie, we've got about two minutes to the end of the show.
Well, Gus, in all due respect, I don't think that is a terribly practical solution. I think you could move toward national referendum. I mean, many states do have that. But I think there are dozens and dozens of issues that come across senators' desks every single week. And I don't think you're going to have, votes every day on important issues. It's just not going to work that way. I think, look, you know, we've gotten a couple of questions kind of dancing around this basic issue. How do you make government responsive to the needs of ordinary people? That's what Gus is saying in his way. He says, why isn't Congress listening to the needs of ordinary people? Now, I think his idea of, you know, referendums every other day is not a practical solution. The practical solution is the old-fashioned, difficult process of electing people who serve ordinary Americans. That's what it's about. If you have a government that works for ordinary Americans, we will have a situation where our people have health care, where they have decent-paying jobs, where the wages in this country are decent, where women's rights are protected. We will not have that if government is owned and controlled by big money interests. So there's no cute way, in my view, no magic formula. The way that happens is through grassroots organizing, getting people out to vote, educating people about the important issues facing our country.
So tag, we're all in. Senator Sanders, thanks so much for being with us again today.
Right, my pleasure, Tom.
Always a pleasure. We'll be back tomorrow. And until then, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires your participation. Show up. Get out there. Get involved. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
Been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com, everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.